history often seems inevitable. When we look back at a historical event, we usually look at it with the outcomes or the results in mind. For example, when we think of World War II, we know that it ended in 1945. We know that the Allies won. Our entire view of that war is framed by those two facts. So when we study the year 1944, we know that the end is near, that within a year the war would be over. But that's not how the people who lived at the time experienced it. They didn't know that things would turn out the way they did. They felt about as sure of the future as we feel about our own future. Think about it. How sure are you about how things are going to turn out? How sure are you about who will win the next World Cup or next year's Academy Awards? How sure are you about who will win the next presidential election or how the crisis in North Korea will turn out? Unless you've been given some sort of supernatural insight, you're probably like me and have no clue about how things will turn out. You feel a sense of uncertainty about these things. That sense of uncertainty, that's the same feeling every generation had about the times in which they lived. Rarely did anything seem inevitable. And someday, decades or centuries from now, people will probably look back at our time in the same way. They'll view our time period with a sense of inevitability, with 20/20 hindsight. But when you view history that way, where you know the outcome of an event, and you view it with that kind of lens, you lose something. You lose the uncertainty, the contingency of the moment. You lose the perspective of the people alive at the time. You lose the element of risk, the stakes that underpinned every event and every decision. I've always felt that American history is especially susceptible to this. In some ways, our country's history seems inevitable. It's like there's a neat linear progression to how our country came to be. America declared independence, fought a war, defeated the British, and created a government, and elected a president. Then it rose to become a world power. Now that America is a fact of life and has become the most powerful nation in the world, it's hard to conceive of anything differently. It's hard to imagine the United States not following that straight path. But the funny thing is, when you study American history, you learn that things didn't seem inevitable for people at the time, and it wasn't all that certain. Today, we wonder if the Republic will survive the problems we have: terrorism, racial divisions, massive debt, crumbling infrastructure, failing schools, the list goes on. We worry that this could be it, that the path we are on right now could lead to the ultimate demise of the country. And while many of these concerns are legitimate and leave us feeling very unsettled, when we study our history, we find that this unsettled feeling has always been there. At no point in our country's history did we ever feel totally secure or that a prosperous future was guaranteed. And many times, we felt that we were right on the precipice of monumental success or epic failure. There is one event in particular that I will focus on in this episode. It's an event of critical importance to our country and the world, without which we may never become a world power. It's a story that challenges our historical bias towards inevitability and the very meaning of what it means to be an American. It involves a great deal of trickery, deception, and spur-of-the-moment decisions. And it's a story with enormous implications for the world today. That story, the Louisiana Purchase, is the subject of this episode of This American President, The Art of the Steal. Whenever people trace the beginning of our country, they usually go back to our forefathers who were persecuted in Europe, the ones who traveled across the ocean to find a place where they could be free. For them, finding a better life, one free of oppression, meant going west into the New World. So they came and established colonies in North America in the 17th century. But even after these colonies were established, the idea of going west remained. Settlers continued to look farther west into the North American continent. They heard about an endless expanse of rich and fertile land, about a massive continent, untapped, ready for the taking. Little was known about it, and that gave it an aura of mystery and adventure. To them, it promised freedom and independence, and that dream remained for generations of Americans. Even when America became an independent republic, the founders fantasized about life beyond the Mississippi River. For the founders, going west wasn't just about new land. It was about their ideals. They saw it as a way to spread their values. They dreamed of expanding the dominion of liberty to a wider part of the world. This is what they called the Empire of Liberty. It would not be an empire for the sake of conquest, but an empire to expand the interests of freedom, to bring more people under the blessings of liberty. As George Washington wrote, quote, "The bosom of America is open to the oppressed and persecuted of all nations and religions. Let the poor, the needy, and oppressed of the earth, and those who want land, resort to the fertile plains of our western country." It was a place where oppression would be no more, and Americans could pursue life, liberty, and happiness. Now, it's fashionable to talk about the fact that many of the founders had personal interests in Western settlement, that many or most of them had investments in or purchased tons of Western land. And this is undeniably true. Washington himself said, quote, "Land is the most permanent estate and the most likely to increase in value." He didn't see anything unseemly in the competition for land. Anyone, he declared, who neglected the, quote, "present opportunity of hunting out good lands will never regain it." I think modern observers like to assume that this somehow compromised their ideals. I don't think that that's necessarily true. The founders were very open about their belief in the right of property. They didn't see anything wrong with seeking out their own private interests, and often believed that it was consistent with the public's broader interests. Washington once wrote a friend about land, saying, quote, "There's a large field before you, an opening prospect in the backcountry for adventurers, where numbers resort to, and where an enterprising man with very little money may lay the foundation of a noble estate." And many Americans believe that land, rather than stock investments or speculation, was the key to a virtuous citizenry. As one historian wrote, 9 out of every 10 Americans lived and made their livings on farms, and very few doubted the moral superiority of their agrarian way of life. To own land enough to feed and clothe the family and raise enough of a marketable crop to trade or sell for what the land could not yield seemed close enough to paradise for anyone. The crowds and corruption of city life and the dubious manipulations of merchant princes struck most yeomen as unsavory and threatening. Western settlement really picked up after the American Revolution, and the numbers are spectacular. Historian Gordon S. Wood writes, quote, "Before the Revolution, the territory of Kentucky had contained almost no white settlers. By the early 1780s, however, it had more than 20,000. By the end of the century, it had grown over to 220,000 people, and people marveled at the fact that not a single adult had been born or grown up within its borders. Although the United States were concentrated on the east coast of the continent, its citizens were venturing to lands just past the western borders of those states, right up to the territory just east of the Mississippi River. So during the founding and even before, Americans were looking west. It was part of their vision for the expansion of liberty, and also part of their own individual personal ambitions. But two well-known factors challenged these American ideals. The first was the spread of American slavery by settlers into western lands. Many settlers brought their slaves into the new territories. If slavery was part of settlement, how could America claim to be creating an empire of liberty? And the second was the Native American population in the territories. Since the arrival of European settlers in the 16th century, the Native American population in North America collapsed from tens of millions in the 1500s to a couple million by the late 1700s, due mainly to disease, but also from war and enslavement. To Native Americans, white settlers were a threat to their already threatened civilization. By the end of the 18th century, whites and Native Americans had found themselves on the opposite sides of numerous wars fighting for dominion over territory. Although the United States had won independence from Britain, the North American continent was still not free of European authority. Other European countries continued to claim territory in the Americas. To give you an idea of what the map looked like, I want you to either Google image or picture North America in your head. By the late 18th century, the United States at that time consisted of the west coast of the continent. Britain controlled the area now known as Canada. Spain claimed what is now Florida. most of what was west of the Mississippi and Mexico. And to make it more confusing, France contested some of what Spain owned. These European superpowers often sent military or civilian governors to enforce their claims. And to top it off, these powers, along with others, had a history of colonizing the Caribbean with its rich sugar trade. The new American Republic felt encircled or confined by the European superpowers. So when we talk about Britain, France, and Spain, we aren't just talking about the European continent. We're also talking about their massive empires in North America. And these empires were not all that friendly. Borders were not well defined and often disputed. Sometimes violence broke out. Both the British and the French, who had lost territory in North America in wars, hoped to reclaim their empires in the New World and were engaged in off-again, on-again wars. These two countries, Britain and France, had fought wars with each other from time to time ever since the Middle Ages. But by the late 18th century, they were in a new age that promised unprecedented devastation. Ever since 1789, France was in the throes of violent revolution. It was inspired and caused in part by the American Revolution. France's citizens had overthrown their government, erased the social order, and executed the royal family, as well as thousands of its aristocrats and clergymen. What made France dangerous was its desire to export its revolutionary ideals abroad. In doing so, it hoped to get rid of monarchy and the existing social order everywhere else. And since the revolution was about its citizens, France mobilized its entire population for the sake of revolution. This posed an existential threat to the entire European continent, where every other major power was governed by a monarchy and a long-established nobility. To counter this revolutionary threat, France's European enemies had to marshal more of their resources to meet that threat. Add to that the fact that following the French Revolution, France was now led by one of the most brilliant military leaders in world history, Napoleon Bonaparte. The era of total war was beginning. The Napoleonic Wars raged from about 1803 to 1815. Sometimes the fighting would stop after a major victory, but even then, there was always a sense that war could break out at any time. Since the United States had intimate relationships with both France and Britain, it found itself caught in between. Although the U.S. tried to remain neutral, satisfying one power often led to conflicts with the other. As a result, Britain and France both attacked American shipping and kidnapped American sailors, impressing them into service. And both Britain and France had allies in various Native American tribes, which they incited to violence against Western American settlers. For the United States, the presence of three empires in North America, Britain, France, and Spain, empires at war among themselves, presented a national security threat and an obstacle to American dreams to explore the rest of the continent. And you have to remember, the United States was an infant country at this time. It needed French help to defeat the British in its War of Independence. Its army had disbanded after the American Revolution. Its entire navy consisted of about 14 ships. France and Britain were grown-up countries. They had been around, arguably, for a millennia. And by 1800, the United States was just 24 years old. So there was a real fear that the country, that its citizens, had sacrificed so much to secure, the country they considered the world's best hope for liberty, would be destroyed by European powers even before it had a chance to breathe. If you put yourself in that time, it wasn't an unreasonable fear. There was a real fear that for a nation so young and unprepared, to involve itself in a war among heavyweights was basically suicide. So our early presidents, George Washington and John Adams, were consumed with keeping America free from foreign entanglements. That's the setting for this story. As I said earlier, there are several presidents involved, and here we will meet one of them, the one who looms largest in this story, Thomas Jefferson. In 1800, Thomas Jefferson was elected the third president of the United States. By then, he was 57 years old. He had served as the second vice president of the United States, the first secretary of state, the minister to France, the governor of Virginia, and a delegate to the Second Continental Congress, where he was the principal author of the Declaration of Independence. Oh yeah, he was also the author of the bill establishing religious freedom. So needless to say, he was one of the most accomplished men among the founding fathers. And his election also ushered in a new era in American politics. The first two presidents, George Washington and John Adams, tended to side with the Federalists. They were the party that supported a stronger central government, and they identified with the interests of the merchant class in New England. And through Secretary of Treasury Alexander Hamilton, they instituted a national bank to fund the country's debt. Although Thomas Jefferson served in both Washington and Adams' administrations, behind the scenes he was running an opposition movement that became the Democratic-Republican Party. For the purpose of this episode, I'll just call it the Republican Party, since that's what many people called it then. But it wasn't the same thing as the modern Republican Party, although there are similarities. In fact, Jefferson's Republican Party was technically the ancestor of the modern Democratic Party. At any rate, Jefferson's Republican Party opposed the Federalists and supported a weaker federal government, placed a greater emphasis on states' rights, and viewed banks and merchants with suspicion. They opposed Hamilton's bank and its funding of the debt. The party's base was concentrated mainly in the South and had a bit more of a populist bent. It identified with the common man, including farmers and Western settlers. But one of the biggest divides between the Federalists and the Republicans was their views on foreign policy. Since American merchants were heavily invested in trade with Great Britain, the Federalists favored increasing ties with America's former oppressor. It also didn't hurt that America shared a common culture, ethnicity, and religion with Britain. And since the Federalists favored a strong central government, they were less apt to recoil at the thought of a monarchy. In fact, two Federalist leaders, John Adams and Alexander Hamilton, were highly complimentary of the British monarchy. They sometimes mused that democracy tended towards anarchy and that a monarchy was a better alternative. This mortified Jefferson and his Republicans, who believed that the Federalists were willing to sacrifice all the United States fought for in the Revolution and sell out to British interests, and maybe even transform the country back into a monarchy. Jefferson, having lived in France, believed the French citizens, not the aristocracy or the British, to be our true brethren, especially after they assisted us in our own revolution and were fighting their own revolution. And to Jefferson and his supporters, Britain never ceased being the enemy in the years after the American Revolution. Jefferson's arch-rival, Alexander Hamilton, even accused Jefferson of having, quote, a womanish attachment to France and a womanish resentment against Great Britain. To Jefferson, the American and French revolutions were two sides of the same coin, part of the titanic struggle between liberty and tyranny. When discussing the French Revolution, Jefferson said that, quote, the liberty of the whole earth was depending on the issue of the contest. He added, quote, rather than it should have failed, I would have seen half the earth desolated. Were there but an Adam and Eve left in every country and left free, it would be better than as it now is.
Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Paul Brandis introducing my podcast, Countdown to Dallas. It's a fascinating, in-depth look at the seemingly unconnected events that led to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's based on my book of the same title. In that book and in this podcast, I go all the way back to 1939, when Lee Harvey Oswald was born into a troubled and dysfunctional family. I'll follow his transient and often violent teenage years and young adulthood, painting a fuller picture of the man who would later become Kennedy's killer. I also take a look at events unfolding in that era, like Cuba and Vietnam, and I'll unpack the conspiracy theories too, not one of which has ever been conclusively proven. Subscribe to Countdown to Dallas at evergreenpodcasts.com or your favorite listening app, October 31st.
So these two parties represented two very different visions of American foreign policy, and each felt the other threatened the security and very existence of the country. The Federalists believed that the Republicans' pro-French stance would lead it to war against Britain, possibly destroying the Union itself. The Republicans believed that the Federalists' pro-British stance would relegate the United States to British tyranny once again, erasing the gains of the American Revolution. Jefferson's often been portrayed as a study in contradictions, so much so that it's a bit of a cliché. A ton of literature has been written on him being a spokesperson for liberty and yet a slaveholder, or being a member of America's elite and yet a populist. And of course, there are allegations that he fathered children from Sally Hemings, one of the many human beings he enslaved. These items are valid subjects of debate, but they aren't the focus of this episode. There is one contradiction, however, that I will focus on, and that's the fact that Thomas Jefferson was a historical unicorn. He was the rare combination of both the sage philosopher and shrewd politician. Think about it. How many individuals of history, known for their philosophical abilities, were also successful politicians? How many were both deep thinkers and successful practitioners in the arena of politics, especially Republican politics? Can you say that about Aristotle or John Locke or Rousseau? Most people, when they think of Thomas Jefferson, think of the great thinker, the man who pondered America's highest ideals and put them into writing, who wrote the stirring words of the Declaration of Independence. And he did all of that. Jefferson was a master of eloquence. One of my favorite speeches in American history is Jefferson's first inaugural address, delivered in 1801. If you have a chance, you should read it. It's one of the most eloquent American documents ever written. When you go to Jefferson's memorial in Washington, D.C., his words are chiseled on the walls, testifying to his brilliance. Whenever I go to his memorial, I see people stare up at the words. They might not know much about Jefferson, but they are moved by what he wrote. That's the power of his eloquence. But these rhetorical skills and philosophical musings mask something else altogether, a cold-blooded political strategist. Washington is usually considered the greatest founder. Franklin is often considered the wisest, and Hamilton the most brilliant. But in the end, Jefferson was the most politically successful. He was the architect of a political party that won 7 U.S. presidential elections in a row, from 1800 to 1824, still the record for any party to this day. He was the founder of the first political dynasty in American history, and arguably, he had more presidential disciples than any other president. James Madison, James Monroe, John Quincy Adams, Andrew Jackson, Martin Van Buren, James K. Polk, Andrew Johnson, and even Franklin Roosevelt to some degree identified themselves as coming from the tradition of Thomas Jefferson. And if we include presidential candidates who ran and lost, that number goes even higher. To Jefferson and his supporters, his election in 1800 constituted a restoration of what they believed to be the true revolution of 1776, away from the Federalist policies of Washington and Hamilton and Adams, which they believed betrayed American values. And one of Jefferson's strongest principles was a strict adherence to the letter of the U.S. Constitution. He felt that the Federalists had expanded the power of the federal government beyond what the Constitution itself had permitted. Now, Jefferson wasn't against an empowered federal government per se, but he felt that the Constitution provided it with sufficient powers and that it could go no further than what was explicitly stated. The Federalists had used the necessary and proper clause of the Constitution to claim implied powers, those not spelled out in the document itself. In response, Jefferson argued, quote, "To take a single step beyond the boundaries thus specially drawn around the powers of Congress is to take possession of a boundless field of power." For Jefferson, the argument of implied powers, though occasionally used for good, could easily be used to justify the use of government power for anything, the pathway to tyranny through the back door. As we will see, Jefferson himself would struggle with the boundaries of government power. While Jefferson built a dynasty, he didn't do it alone. His partner in crime was a fellow Virginian, the second man we will cover in this episode, James Madison. When Jefferson took office as president, he made Madison his Secretary of State. By then, Madison was about 50 years old. It's always easy to view Madison as second fiddle to Jefferson, but Madison is a giant in American history in his own right. He is forever known as the father of the Constitution, the man who had most to do with its final form, making him a man of monumental importance. He authored 29 of the 85 Federalist Papers, which contributed to the ratification of the Constitution. And if that wasn't enough, he was also the biggest force behind the ratification of the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to our Constitution. And he achieved all this before he reached the age of 40. He was a man whose brilliance was acknowledged by men on both sides of the political spectrum. He was trusted by both George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, men who found themselves on opposite sides of many political issues. Madison's brilliance was easy to overlook. At 5'4", he had a fragile build. He remains to this day the shortest president in American history. He had a weak constitution and was often stricken with poor health. Historian Joseph Ellis wrote, quote, "Little Jemmy Madison had the frail and discernibly fragile appearance of a career librarian or schoolmaster, forever lingering on the edge of some fatal ailment." Unlike larger-than-life figures like Washington and Jefferson, Madison didn't inspire men with his charisma or eloquence. Author Gary Rosen referred to Madison as, quote, "the nerdy founder, the note-taker, the committeeman, a rather dull, proper Virginia squire whose ideas sparkled far more than his domestic life or persona." What Madison lacked in presence, he had both in intellectual and strategic brilliance. Like Jefferson, Madison was both the thinker and the practitioner. To many, he remains the greatest political philosopher in American history, another historical unicorn who understood how to turn goals into practical realities, even more than Jefferson. A fellow delegate to the Constitutional Convention said that Madison, quote, "blends together the profound politician with the scholar." While Jefferson touted the spread of liberty, Madison was an astute observer of human nature. In Federalist 51, Madison famously wrote, quote, "Ambition must be made to counteract ambition. The interest of the man must be connected with the constitutional rights of the place. It may be a reflection on human nature that such devices should be necessary to control the abuses of government. But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself." And Madison was the most intense student of all the founders. A colleague said of his work ethic, quote, "From a spirit of industry and application which he possesses to a most eminent degree, he always comes forward the best informed man at any point in debate." But much of Madison's work was done anonymously or behind the scenes. And this is one of the factors that made Jefferson and Madison's relationship work. Jefferson was often the face of the movement, Madison the man behind the scenes. And Madison had no problem with this setup. He cared more about getting things done and less about taking credit. Together, these two historical rarities became a fiercely effective team, one of the most successful in American history, and they were indispensable to each other's success. It was this formidable team that found itself running the new American Republic in 1801. But an event occurred just before Jefferson took office, a secret event that would have profound implications for his presidency and the history of the United States. The event was the signing of the Third Treaty of San Ildefonso on October 1st, 1800. To understand the importance of this treaty, let's look a little bit at the context. Remember when I mentioned Europe's empires in North America? Well, ever since the 17th century, the British were busy colonizing the East Coast. At the same time, the French were colonizing the central part of North America. This area covered as far south as present-day New Orleans, as far north as Canada, as far west as present-day North Dakota, and as far east as Newfoundland. It was a huge section of the entire continent and was named Louisiana after French King Louis XIV. By colonizing this area, the French were hoping to discover a northwest passage to China, exploit the territory's natural resources, and spread Catholicism among the native population. British, French, and Spanish interests in North America, as in Europe and everywhere else, collided violently. The Seven Years' War broke out in 1754 and lasted until 1763. When the war ended, France lost the massive Louisiana territory. Britain became the dominant superpower in North America, retaining the colonies on the East Coast and acquiring Canada. Spain received almost all of the Louisiana territory formerly owned by France. Since France lost most of its North American holdings, it decided to focus instead on the lucrative sugar trade in the Caribbean. Although they were the victors, Britain and Spain would soon struggle to maintain its power in America. Britain would lose its colonies during the American Revolution, and Spain struggled to keep the massive Louisiana Territory, especially since it was trying to hold on to large areas in South and Central America, including modern-day Mexico. The Americans certainly feared European control of the Louisiana Territory, but there was one specific thing they really feared, one thing that kept its leaders up at night. As I mentioned earlier, the Mississippi River basically formed the western border of the United States. It also formed the eastern border of the Louisiana Territory. But the river was more than a border. As the fourth longest river in the world, with all of its tributaries, it was the lifeblood of the Western American economy. Thanks to the river's silt deposits, the land directly surrounding the river were and are among the most fertile agricultural regions in the country. And one city was the gateway to all the commerce that went through the Mississippi. That city was New Orleans. Control of New Orleans basically meant control of America's Western economy. That's a fact that we should keep in mind throughout this episode. Spain now had control of the Louisiana Territory, and therefore New Orleans. Thus, in their hands rested the livelihoods of thousands of American settlers in the West. Spain realized they could control commerce of the whole Mississippi River just by keeping a small military force in New Orleans, and they would occasionally flex their muscles to demonstrate that control. In 1784, the Spanish banned American trade in the Mississippi River. American settlers were outraged at the Spanish government. But this also led to divisions within the United States. For many American merchants in New England, the shutting down of trade in Mississippi meant less competition. This angered many of the Western settlers who saw that this was helping New England at their expense. Some Western Americans began considering seceding from the United States. Some were even in touch with British or Spanish agents who were promising a better deal than the one from Washington, D.C. Many founding fathers, including Jefferson and Madison, believed that the issue of the Mississippi was one that could potentially destroy the Union itself. Eventually, the United States would sign a treaty with Spain in 1795, guaranteeing U.S. navigation rights in the Mississippi. But in the back of many Americans' minds was the reality that its Western economy was still under the control of a foreign power. And as more American settlers moved out west, the Mississippi became even more important. For a time, trade continued and the Western economy grew. The Napoleonic Wars would change the calculus. By 1799, the 30-year-old Napoleon was the most powerful man in France, and, thanks to his military brilliance, his country was now the rising power in Europe. By this time, Spain was France's main ally in its war against Britain and the rest of its enemies. France was clearly the stronger power in this alliance and could make Spain do its bidding. So back to what I mentioned earlier. On October 1st, 1800, France and Spain signed the Third Treaty of Ildefonso. Well, in reality, France basically forced Spain to sign the treaty. In doing so, Spain gave France back her massive North American empire. In exchange, Napoleon granted Spain Tuscany, a very beautiful province, but a far cry from the massive Louisiana Territory. It was a sign that Napoleon's ambitions might extend beyond Europe and into North America. And as I mentioned earlier, the treaty was conducted in secret. To keep the Third Treaty of San Ildefonso a secret, Napoleon allowed Spanish troops to remain in the territory until given further notice. 3 weeks into Jefferson's presidency, on March 29, 1801, the American envoy in London, Rufus King, wrote to Secretary of State Madison, informing him of a credible rumor that France was secretly forcing Spain to give back the Louisiana Territory. If that happened, France could possibly take possession of New Orleans. It was one thing to have Spain, a weak power, to have a presence in New Orleans, the gateway to American commerce. Now it might be the more powerful Napoleon-led French that would have control over the American economy. And if France had claim to Louisiana and sent forces there, it could use that as a base to threaten the young United States. To Jefferson and Madison, the idea that France would make an agreement in secret was a potential sign of treachery or future aggression, a likely precursor to a French invasion of North America. While it was not yet an existential threat, it might be one in the very near future. In a time before radio, telephones, television, and the internet, world leaders had little contact with each other. And if they did, none of it was instantaneous. So you can imagine Jefferson and Madison having learned this rumor, but having little information, pondering Napoleon's mysterious intentions. As I said earlier, the French were involved in the lucrative sugar trade in the Caribbean. And there was one place in particular that served as the hub for French power there, the island of Saint-Domingue. It was the western half of the island Hispaniola, now called Haiti, and it was the crown jewel of French interest in the Caribbean. France had acquired the territory from Spain back in 1697. By 1740, Saint-Domingue, along with Jamaica, were the world's chief suppliers of sugar, and it was the most profitable French colony in the entire world. And for any student of geopolitics, the colony was also a potential base to invade North America, an observation not lost upon both the French and the Americans. Saint-Domingue also happened to be the site of some of the worst conditions of slavery in all of history. Obviously, slavery is abhorrent wherever it exists, but historians consider the type of slavery implemented by the French in Saint-Domingue as uniquely cruel by any standards. The African slave population in the colony grew from a couple thousand at the end of the 17th century to about 500,000 by the end of the 18th century. By then, about 30,000 enslaved Africans were imported into the colony every year. Disease and other forms of barbaric treatment killed over 50% of all imported slaves within a year. The slaves were worked to the point of near death and given the barest minimum of food and shelter. Slaves who disobeyed experienced a wide array of punishments like extreme torture, burning, castration, rape, being eaten alive by insects, or buried alive. Although King Louis XIV tried to regulate the level of cruelty, masters frequently failed to obey it. When the French Revolution broke out in 1789, there were 500,000 slaves in Saint-Domingue. At the same time, there were only about 30,000 whites there. So the slaves outnumbered the whites by about 8-1. After a century of French atrocities, and with France distracted by revolution, the slaves of Saint-Domingue sensed an opportunity. They rose up in rebellion in 1791. And thus, what is known to history as the Haitian Revolution, the biggest slave revolt since Spartacus, began. The combination of rampant disease and pent-up resentments from centuries of European exploitation ensured this to be one of the deadliest and most brutal revolts in history. Former slaves committed extreme violence towards whites, pillaging their homes and burning their sugar plantations. Slave masters and their families were dragged from their beds to be raped, tortured, or killed, and the heads of French children were placed on spikes. Surviving whites grouped together and fought back, responding in kind with similar atrocities. At different points, both Britain and Spain intervened in the rebellion, opportunistically hoping to secure their own interest in the sugar trade. But the intense tropical weather, disease, and violence in Saint-Domingue made it a death trap. But Napoleon, who had enjoyed spectacular military successes in Europe, hardly felt that a slave rebellion was beyond his ability to suppress. So in December 1801, he sent his brother-in-law, General Charles Leclerc, and 40,000 troops to end the rebellion. History was now providing Napoleon with two opportunities in North America. He could now send forces across the Atlantic with two objectives. First, to pacify Saint-Domingue, and second, to reestablish the French presence in Louisiana. And he would do so secretly. On June 4, 1802, he wrote to his Minister of the Navy, Denis de Crée, that, quote, "It is our intention to take Louisiana as soon as possible, and that the expedition take place in the greatest secrecy. It should appear to be heading for Saint-Domingue." Reinforcing Napoleon's wishes, his foreign minister Charles Maurice de Talleyrand wrote Admiral Denis de Crée, quote, "You must be able to disguise these measures so that the Americans will not know of them." French forces were gathering in Holland, using the country as a way station to execute Napoleon's order in secret and secure France's empire in North America. While Jefferson was ignorant of these plans, he did know about the rebellion in Saint-Domingue and the possibility of France taking over Louisiana, and these things made him nervous. And it was made far worse by the fact that America was woefully unprepared militarily. As I said earlier, the U.S. military was disbanded after the American Revolution, in part because Americans saw standing armies as tools of oppression. If France intervened in Saint-Domingue, it might be in a position to secure New Orleans. In that case, there would be virtually nothing to stop them from taking over the port, the Mississippi, and whatever else they wanted from the United States. This posed a dilemma for President Jefferson. He had served as the former ambassador to France and was a renowned Francophile. He remained a prominent American apologist for the French Revolution. Remember, he was the guy who was said to have had, quote, a womanish attachment to France. His enemies feared that he and Madison would sell out American interests to France and involve the nation in war against Britain. So when Jefferson wrote to the U.S. envoy in Paris, Robert R. Livingston, in April 1802, his words would probably have shocked his enemies. But it is a testament to how much of a threat France posed to the United States. Going off of rumors about French acquisition of Louisiana, Jefferson wrote, quote, "The cession of Louisiana and the Floridas by Spain to France works most sorely on the U.S. Cannot forbear recurring to it personally, so deep is the impression it makes in my mind. It completely reverses all the political relations of the U.S. and will form a new epoch in our political course." The Francophile Jefferson then referred back to the years of friendship between his country and France, quote, "Of all nations of any consideration, France is the one which hitherto has offered the fewest points on which we could have any conflict of right, and the most points of a communion of interests. From these causes, we have ever looked to her as our natural friend, as one with which we could never have an occasion of difference. Her growth, therefore, we viewed as our own, her misfortunes ours." Jefferson continued, saying, "Our attachment to France ended when it came to one place in particular." Quote, "There is on the globe one single spot, the possessor of which is our natural and habitual enemy. It is New Orleans, through which the produce of 3/8 of our territory must pass to market. And from its fertility, it will ere long yield more than half of our whole produce and contain more than half of our inhabitants. France, placing herself in that door, assumes to us an attitude of defiance. Spain may have retained it quietly for years. Her pacific dispositions, her feeble state, would induce her to increase our facilities there, so that her possession of the place would hardly be felt by us, and it would not perhaps be very long before some circumstance might arise which might make the cession of it to us the price of something of more worth to her. Not so can it ever be in the hands of France. The impetuosity of her temper, the energy and restlessness of her character, placed in a point of eternal friction with us and our character, which, though quiet and loving peace and the pursuit of wealth, is high-minded, despising wealth in competition with insult or injury, enterprising and as energetic as any nation on earth. These circumstances render it impossible that France and the U.S. can continue long friends when they meet in so irritable a position. They as well as we must be blind if they do not see this. And we must be very improvident if we do not begin to make arrangements on that hypothesis. The day that France takes possession of New Orleans fixes the sentence which is to restrain her forever within her low water mark. It seals the union of two nations who, in conjunction, can maintain exclusive possession of the ocean. From that moment, we must marry ourselves to the British fleet and nation. We must turn all our attentions to a maritime force for which our resources place on a very high ground."
Hello everyone. My name is Tom Kearns, and I host the Anglo-Saxon England podcast, where I cover the history and culture of England from the departure of the Romans in the 5th century to the Norman conquest in 1066. So far, we've surveyed the collapse of Roman rule in Britain, the migration of the Anglo-Saxons, and the history of Northumbria from its beginnings in the mists of legend to its destruction at the hands of Viking raiders in the 9th century. I hope you'll come and give it a go.
There are a few key points here to note. The first is that Jefferson affirms the importance of New Orleans, basically saying that the port city is a non-negotiable for the new republic. The fact that he was willing to risk hostilities with France over the city, despite America's weak military state, testifies to just how critical the city was. The second is the not-so-subtle threat to join with Britain against France and to initiate a naval buildup. Britain and France were temporarily at peace in 1802, but as I said earlier, war was always looming. Jefferson's threat to side with Britain would have shocked many of his enemies. After all, he was the man they accused of irrationally hating Great Britain. They say politics makes strange bedfellows. Well, Jefferson in Britain struck many as one of the strangest. It's kind of like that Nixon goes to China moment, meaning to say that no one would have predicted that an anti-communist Richard Nixon would go to communist China. Add to that the fact that Jefferson, since Washington's administration, had accused the Federalists of selling out to the British because of their sympathies towards monarchy or their desire to increase economic and diplomatic ties with London. Jefferson's attacks helped him defeat the Federalists and obtain the presidency. And yet, there he was as president, threatening to do the same thing. This kind of thing infuriated Jefferson's opponents. Federalists found it galling that he would criticize their policies, ride that wave of criticism to office, only to implement the same policies he criticized without paying any political price. To them, it was hypocritical. And for anyone who follows politics, these kinds of things are not unheard of. Have you ever seen a politician win an election criticizing whoever is in office, but once they take office, they end up continuing a lot of the policies that their predecessor, who they criticized, started? And those who supported that politician justify it by saying, well, they have to compromise to political reality. And those who oppose that politician say, well, if they kept that policy, why did they say they wanted to change it in the first place? Well, I say all that to say that the Founding Fathers, brilliant as they were, also dealt with many of the same political dynamics we deal with today. Historians now view this as part of Jefferson's political skills. His opponents called it hypocrisy, pure and simple. It makes you wonder how the actions of our current leaders will be viewed as hypocrisy or political genius, or both. At any rate, it gives us further proof of Jefferson's ability to shift from idealism to political reality. The man who once fantasized about a world free of tyranny brought about by upheavals like the French Revolution, who saw Britain as the worldwide king of tyranny, now threatened to do to his beloved France exactly what his enemies tried to do, ally with Britain against it. Jefferson adjusted quickly and shrewdly. In writing this letter to Livingston, his envoy in Paris, Jefferson was hoping to signal to France just how serious Americans considered New Orleans and the Mississippi to their own security, that they may be willing to fight for it. So the focus of this episode is mainly on the American side, but there are two people on the French side that are critical to this story, both of whom were Napoleon's top advisors. The first was Charles Maurice de Talleyrand, France's Minister of Foreign Affairs. By this time, Talleyrand was in his late 40s, and his life reflected the twists and turns of French politics at the time. Talleyrand came from a family with a noble bloodline, but with little actual wealth. So like many families at the time, they saw careers in the church as a means to support themselves. The young Talleyrand went to seminary and became a priest and later a bishop. During this time, he entered the realm of court politics, becoming an agent general of the clergy, which basically meant he was one of just two people who represented the Catholic Church before the French crown. His job was to defend the rights of the church, but being so close to power allowed him to enjoy some pretty nice perks. He, like most court clerics, indulged in fine wine and food and spent more time with beautiful women than with his fellow churchmen. Still, he was known as a staunch defender of the interests of the clergy. The French Revolution, which began in 1789, destroyed the lives of thousands of clergymen, but not Talleyrand's. He represented the clergy, the first estate, in the Estates General. There, Talleyrand shocked his colleagues and endeared himself to the revolutionaries by doing a complete 180. He proposed the end of the tithe and the nationalization of the Catholic Church's property in France. The man who once vociferously defended the clergy's rights now called for its property to be appropriated by the government. Talleyrand emerged as among the most revolutionary deputies, helping to push for liberal reform of the education system and reorganization of the church on a more democratic basis. This all earned Talleyrand excommunication by the Pope, but his views made him enormously popular in revolutionary France. Talleyrand would find his calling in international diplomacy. He soon found himself in London working to maintain peace between France and Britain. When the French Revolution reached new levels of chaos, he was no longer welcomed in London and headed to the United States for refuge. There he made a fortune through shrewd investments and became close friends with Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. When things moderated in France after the fall of Maximilian Robespierre, it was safe enough for Talleyrand to return home. By late 1796, he was back in France, and by the following year, he was the revolutionary government's foreign minister. and he had the foresight to see that Napoleon's star was rising. He began writing letters to Napoleon as the young general was winning victory after victory and cultivated a political alliance. Talleyrand helped engineer the coup in 1799 that installed Napoleon as consul, which effectively made the young ruler the master of France. Napoleon kept Talleyrand on as foreign minister. The two men had great respect for each other. Napoleon, in particular, found Talleyrand's larger-than-life personality very amusing. This admiration was sufficient to make up for the fact that both men had completely different views and almost agreed on nothing. Whereas Napoleon constantly sought decisive action and preferred to conquer his enemies through war, Talleyrand instead favored using diplomacy to make peace with the rest of Europe, and he harbored a dream to one day forge a lasting peace between France and Napoleon's archenemy Britain. In Talleyrand, Napoleon had a man who survived and thrived in both royal and revolutionary France. Talleyrand was a master of survival, and no small part of his skill rested in his ability to solicit bribes. Much of European diplomacy at this time rested on ministers, envoys, and ambassadors exchanging kickbacks for favors, and Talleyrand was one of the best in the world at this system. The other important French advisor in our story is François Barbet Marbois, Napoleon's Minister of the Treasury. By this time, Marbois was in his mid-50s and had served significant time abroad. In his 30s, he traveled to the United States as the secretary to the French legation, and later became administrator of Saint-Domingue. During his stay in the United States, Marbois, like Talleyrand, befriended prominent American leaders like John Adams, and he developed a lifelong admiration for the citizens and culture of the United States, later saying, quote, "These same men who open doors for themselves and buy their own food are those who have brought about this revolution, and who, when it is necessary, raise a musket to their soldiers and march on the enemy. And between ourselves, I am not sure that people who have porters, stewards, butlers, and covered carriages with springs would have offered the same resistance to despotism." Marbois, though not a brilliant man, developed a solid reputation for integrity and honesty. Unfortunately, that was not enough to shield him from the hardships of the French Revolution, where he was suspected both of treason and royalism several times. In 1797, he was arrested and sent to French Guiana, and then transferred to the island of Oléron. But when Napoleon rose to the peak of political power in France, he heard about the honest and loyal Marbois. In a spectacular change of fortune, he freed Marbois and hired him to run his treasury ministry. Talleyrand and Marbois, more than any other Frenchman, had Napoleon's ear. But they both had very different opinions on what to do with Louisiana. Although Talleyrand desired forging peace treaties with other European powers, he also believed strongly in the value of colonies to the French Empire as a whole. So he advised Napoleon to keep Louisiana and expand their holdings on the continent. Marbois, more fiscally minded, saw foreign colonies as a drain on the treasury, and he supported selling France's North American territories as a way to cut their losses and reap a windfall of cash. And France could use that windfall to finance its war with Britain. While Talleyrand and Marbois remained powerful men, their authority came only from what the mercurial French dictator gave them. In a sense, the future of the United States rested, in large part, on the whims of the great man in Paris, Napoleon Bonaparte. Jefferson and Madison knew that their infant nation didn't pull the same weight as the French superpower. Even though we focused mainly on the American perspective in this episode, all of this was really a sideshow to what Europe considered the main event, the impending war between Britain and revolutionary France. So as a side player, the United States was not in the strongest position. But they were not without any leverage at all. Through three men, the American president and the Secretary of State worked methodically to influence Napoleon's perceptions and prevent him from securing his claim over Louisiana. The first of the three is a man I brought up earlier, America's minister to France, Robert R. Livingston. Now, I consider Livingston as kind of like a Forrest Gump among the Founding Fathers. He was one of those guys who was there for a lot of big events, but was almost never the center of attention. Livingston was a native New Yorker who served as a delegate to the Continental Congress, where he was a member of the Committee of Five that drafted the Declaration of Independence, along with Jefferson, John Adams, and Benjamin Franklin. He became Chancellor of New York, basically the highest judicial officer of the state, and would thereafter be referred to as, quote, the Chancellor. In this position, he had the honor of being the first man to ever administer the oath of office to a president of the United States, which he did for George Washington in New York City in 1789. He eventually joined Jefferson's Republican Party and in 1801 was appointed America's minister to Napoleon's France. Now, Livingston was one of those second-tier founders, impressive in his own right, but not quite at the level of the Washingtons and the Jeffersons. But he was, as described by historian Charles Ceramy, an ambitious man, not content with his second-tier status. Jefferson and Madison both kept him on as their man in Paris, but they were wary of his ambition. When Livingston heard rumors that France may be considering selling to America territory around the Mississippi River, he saw an opportunity for a diplomatic breakthrough that would enshrine him as an American hero, and maybe even earn him a spot as President Jefferson's vice presidential running mate in 1804. And it wasn't a far-fetched idea. When Thomas Pinckney negotiated the treaty guaranteeing American navigation rights in 1795, it earned him a spot on the Federalist ticket as President Adams' running mate the following year. So after Jefferson and Madison took office, Livingston immediately began inundating them with letters describing his successful attempts at diplomacy with the French. He mentioned that the French were considering selling American land around the Mississippi. Letter after letter, Jefferson begged Madison for instructions as to how much money to offer for that land. But Jefferson and Madison were leery of giving Livingston the satisfaction of a victory and refused to provide him with instructions. Sometimes they didn't even reply to his letters. This infuriated Livingston, who began suspecting them of doing exactly what they were doing, attempting to rob him of a major diplomatic triumph. At one point, Livingston wrote to Madison, complaining, quote, "I am not satisfied from examining my instructions in commission that I am empowered to do anything but the common routine of business. I find that I have no precise diplomatic character, not even an envoy ordinary or extraordinary." It's pretty amazing to think that Jefferson and Madison were willing to delay a major strategic victory for the United States, especially one that might guarantee the nation's security. Perhaps they felt that the time wasn't right, or that the rumors that they heard were just that, rumors. At any rate, they were still willing to use Livingston to influence the French, and it helped that Livingston was particularly close to Marbois. Jefferson's letter I referenced earlier, the one from April 1802 where Jefferson threatens to marry the United States with the British fleet, was sent to Livingston, and did indeed reach the highest levels of France. The second of the three men was Louis-André Pichon. Now, Pichon was a young man in his late 20s, and he had been a back channel between America and France during the Adams administration. Talleyrand put him in charge of the French legation in Washington, D.C. In this position, Pichon reported to Napoleon and Talleyrand gossip and rumors on the goings-on in the American capital. And it was through this man that Jefferson and Madison often played good cop, bad cop. While Jefferson played bad cop by threatening France with an alliance with Britain, Madison would play good cop by claiming that the administration was reluctant to engage in hostilities. He told Pichon that a French military takeover of Louisiana would empower the Federalists who were rabidly pro-British, and that would be the cause of a British-American alliance. At times, Jefferson and Madison fed misinformation to Pichon, giving France the impression that the American settler population in the Western territories were larger than they actually were. The third person was an outsider, someone whose name may be familiar to you, especially if you live in Washington, D.C., Pierre Samuel DuPont, the patriarch of the DuPont family, one of the wealthiest in American history. Pierre DuPont, by this time in his 60s, was a renowned French economist and government official. During the French Revolution, he came close to being executed and escaped with his family to the United States in 1799. He had been close friends with President Jefferson when the future president was minister to France. After immigrating to the United States, DuPont's son founded a gunpowder company that would make their family a fortune. As President Jefferson pondered about what to do over Louisiana, he reached out to the elder DuPont, who still had powerful connections back home in France, and his son Victor DuPont. Jefferson hoped that they could act as private back channels to the French government. When they met, the president impressed upon the DuPonts that he wanted peace, but that French actions were leading them closer to war. Echoing his letter to Livingston, Jefferson told the elder DuPont, quote, "Our circumstances are so imperious as to admit of no delay. whatever power holds the country east of the Mississippi becomes our natural enemy. The president tried to convince them that he also had France's best interests in mind, since they would be outmatched in a war against both Britain and America. Jefferson said it, quote, would annihilate France on the ocean and place it under the despotism of two nations, which I am not reconciled to the more because my own would be one of them. DuPont resisted at first, writing back to Jefferson that he was the one who was drawing both nations to war. He wrote to Jefferson, quote, to say, give up that city or we shall take it from you is not at all persuasive. But DuPont looked at the situation from a financial perspective and believed that a deal would be the best way to resolve the issue. To the president, he wrote, quote, what then are your means of acquiring and persuading France to an amicable cession of her property? Alas, Mr. President, it is payment in money. Consider what the most successful war with France and Spain would cost you, and contract for a party, a half, let us say. The two countries will have made a good bargain. You will have Louisiana and probably the Floridas for the least expenditure possible, and this conquest will be neither envenomed by hatreds nor sullied by human blood. Historians often credit him as the man who came up with the idea that possession of Louisiana could be settled by purchase rather than force. But Jefferson resisted, saying he felt that the idea of purchase legitimated France's possession of the territory, and he wondered whether the federal government or the president had a constitutional right to make the transaction. After all, the Constitution was silent on the issue of acquiring foreign territory. And as we noted earlier, Jefferson was a strict constructionist. But thanks to DuPont, a seed had been planted for a solution that avoided war. DuPont soon met with Napoleon back in France and made the same argument for him, that the expense of war was not worth it, and that both sides stood to gain from a financial settlement. While Jefferson and Madison were doing all they could to signal to France their willingness to defend New Orleans by force, the Spanish did something that inadvertently would boost the American cause. Remember the Third Treaty of San Ildefonso, the one signed on October 1st, 1800 that forced Spain to give back Louisiana to France? Well, the Spanish procrastinated in executing the order, but they did so finally in October 1802. But the following month, the top Spanish official in New Orleans, Juan Ventura Morales, closed the port to American shipping, a repeat of what they did in 1784, and a direct violation of Pinckney's Treaty of 1795. Historian Charles Ceramy speculates that the Prime Minister of Spain, Manuel Godoy, may have done this to stir the pot, provoke the Americans, and scare the French away from taking over Louisiana. As one can imagine, American citizens erupted in anger, just like they did in 1784. But this time, both Westerners and Easterners were outraged. New Orleans by then was just too important for the nation as a whole. Protests broke out nationwide. The Federalists used the situation to accuse the Jefferson administration of failing to protect American interests. And despite the country's weak military position, many Americans were talking war. One Federalist senator, James Ross of Pennsylvania, proposed an expenditure of $5 million that would empower President Jefferson to enlist 50,000 men and capture New Orleans. And the U.S. Senate voted to build 15 gunships for the Mississippi River. All this frightened Pichon, who had already heard Madison claim that the Federalists were itching for war with France to bind America closer to Britain. He wrote a letter to the Spanish expressing disapproval for the closure of New Orleans. Back in Paris, the French government became more aware of American resolve to defend New Orleans, although many, including Napoleon himself, still dreamed of an empire in North America, it became clear that the cost of such a venture was getting higher. Americans were showing that they weren't going to sit idly by with their interests in jeopardy. But not everyone in America was looking for war. Some considered the possibility of purchasing New Orleans and Florida. If America could get a deal on those two locations, it would go a long way to securing America from foreign invasion or control. A congressional committee looked into the issue and mentioned that it believed that both New Orleans and Florida would be worth a total of $2 million. The beat of war drums could be heard throughout the United States. As the situation reached a crisis point, Jefferson and Madison decided to send an envoy to France, someone they trusted more than the ambitious Livingston, someone who could directly convey their viewpoints. For this critical task, they turned to one of their own, James Monroe. Monroe was a fellow Virginian planter who had actually studied law under Jefferson and served under him when he was governor. Unlike Madison and Jefferson, he had served in the army during the American Revolution. Have you ever seen the famous portrait of Washington crossing the Delaware? Well, he's the kid in the painting next to George Washington holding the American flag. While this exact scene probably never happened, he was there with Washington at the Battle of Trenton. He eventually served as a member of the Congress of the Confederation and was appointed as ambassador to France under President George Washington. In 1799, he became the governor of Virginia and developed a reputation as a staunch Republican and an advocate for the Western settlers. As soon as his tenure ended as governor, Jefferson and Madison tasked him to go to France. After all, the president and secretary of state trusted their mentee, James Monroe, much more than they did Robert Livingston. And it also didn't hurt that, unlike most of his counterparts, he spoke French very well. Now, one of the most interesting things to note is how different diplomacy was back then. Some of this might be obvious, but it's important to sit on this for a second. Back then, it took a long time, weeks or months, not only for a diplomat to travel somewhere, but also for him to communicate with his superiors back home. So before you sent out a diplomat, you would have to take a long time to prepare him for his assignment. This meant briefing him on the situation, preparing him mentally for all the tricks of the diplomatic trade, and giving him very clear instructions and parameters. And since your communications with that diplomat would be highly limited once they departed, your instructions had to allow for a very large set of possibilities and directives on what to do given various contingencies. You had to think out as many possible scenarios and make sure you accounted for them. In one letter of instructions written to Monroe and Livingston, Madison gave clear directives on 22 different potential situations. Preparing an envoy for departure or providing them with further instructions required a great deal of energy and thought. And since communications took so long, decisions could be made by envoys that wouldn't get back to their superiors for weeks or even months. So those superiors might still be expending their energies without knowing of decisions being made, thinking up instructions based on circumstances that had already changed. And this would lead to confusion, especially during times of war. It's why you hear about battles being fought after peace treaties were signed. For the most part, when world leaders sent out negotiators to secure peace for their countries, they waited for months in complete suspense. Nowadays, diplomacy is still a hard thing, and it takes years to secure an agreement. Think of how much harder it was back then. Either way, Monroe was headed for France with instructions from Jefferson and Madison. And one of them was to offer up $9 million, or 50 million francs, for New Orleans and Florida. It was more than four times the $2 million that Congress had considered. Robert R. Livingston was not happy about Monroe's arrival. Remember, he was hoping to gain all the glory in a potential agreement with France. The first issue he had was with the titles. Although both men were designated as envoys plenipotentiary, Monroe had the added title of extraordinary plenipotentiary, and thus to the French would appear to have a higher rank. Second, the very fact that Monroe was being sent to France implied that he, rather than Livingston, was Jefferson and Madison's true representative. Livingston feared that after over a year of attempting to negotiate a purchase and failing to receive instructions from Madison, Monroe was poised to steal his thunder.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Burn the Boats from Evergreen Podcasts. I interview political leaders and influencers, folks like award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien and conservative columnist Bill Kristol, about the choices they confront when failure is not an option. I won't agree with everyone I talk to, but I respect anyone who believes in something enough to risk everything for it. Because history belongs to those willing to burn the boats. Episodes are out every other week wherever you get your podcasts.
As Jefferson and Madison worked through the diplomatic channels, they also began to signal their seriousness about an alliance with Britain. At cabinet meetings, they discussed the possibility for such an alliance. In fact, the administration let it be known to Pichon that although Monroe was going to France, he also had full power to go to London, perhaps to make an agreement. By this time, Napoleon's advisors were torn. Some, like Talleyrand, argued for keeping Louisiana and reaping the rewards of its resources. Others, like Marbois, argued that France was better off without its overseas colonies and focusing on the war with Britain. Although Monroe had arrived by the spring of 1803, Livingston delayed engaging with him and continued to try to get a deal on his own. On April 11, 1803, he met alone with Talleyrand. On that day, the French foreign minister startled him by asking, quote, "Would you Americans wish to have the whole of Louisiana?" Livingston was startled by the extravagant offer. Unlike Monroe, he had no instructions from Jefferson and Madison for this scenario, and knew that anything he said might be considered the official line from the U.S. government. He had no idea how much this kind of deal would cost. He opted for caution and responded, quote, "No, our wishes extend only to New Orleans and Florida." Talleyrand persisted, asking Livingston how much he felt the entire territory was worth. Livingston threw out $4 million, or 20 million francs. Talleyrand, insisting that he just came up with the idea on the spot, said he felt that number was much too low. By then, Livingston had only heard rumors of Napoleon's state of mind. What he didn't know was how difficult things were getting for the French dictator. His efforts to pacify Saint-Domingue continued to fail. Although he sent an additional 25,000 troops, the rebellion continued, turning into a quagmire and draining the treasury. The French force in Holland that was to reinforce Leclerc and invade New Orleans had been trapped in the ice the whole winter. Back in January 7, 1803, Napoleon learned that his brother-in-law and his commander on the island, Leclerc, had died the previous November, yet another French casualty of yellow fever. A few days later, Napoleon was said to have muttered, quote, "Damn sugar, damn coffee, damn colonies." The island's independence appeared inevitable. The disaster on Saint-Domingue impressed upon Napoleon the cost of maintaining foreign possessions. By mid-March, he received word that 50,000 men to date had died on Saint-Domingue. At the same time, things were tipping to a crisis point with Britain. Napoleon's successful actions in Western Europe were pushing Britain closer to a declaration of war. Around this time, one of Napoleon's ministers is said to have quoted him as saying, quote, "I shall not keep a possession which will not be safe in our hands, which will perhaps be the cause of a clash with the Americans, or perhaps make them cold towards me. On the contrary, I shall use it to bind them to me, to cause them to break with the British, and I shall create enemies against the latter, who shall one day avenge us. My mind is made up. I shall give Louisiana to the United States. But since they do not have any territory to give us in return, I shall ask them for some money so as to fund the extra armaments which I am preparing to launch against Great Britain." For Napoleon, selling Louisiana would not only reap much-needed cash in the war against Britain, it would also remove the reason for hostility with the United States, maybe even bind it to France and make it an enemy of Britain's. Napoleon was not afraid to make a big decision. In fact, he thrived on being impulsive. He was willing to make the choice, even if it meant giving up an entire empire in the most promising region in the world. On April 11th, Napoleon told Talleyrand, quote, "I renounce Louisiana. I have proved the importance I attach to this province, since my first diplomatic act with Spain had the object of recovering it. I renounce it with the greatest regret. To attempt obstinately to retain it would be folly." Later that day, the meeting between Talleyrand and Livingston referenced earlier occurred. The pace was picking up both in Europe and the United States. Just 3 days before, on April 8th, Jefferson called a cabinet meeting to discuss a potential alliance with Britain. America's top leaders had no idea about France's offer, nor did their envoy have any instructions for such a situation. On April 13th, Livingston wrote to Madison about the offer, quote, "It is so very important that you should be apprised that a negotiation is actually opened, even before Mr. Monroe has been presented. The field open to us is infinitely larger than our instructions contemplated. We shall do all we can to cheapen the purchase, but my present sentiment is that we shall buy." The next day, Monroe joined Livingston for the negotiations. Napoleon had made his mind, but the French and American officials now had to come to an agreement that would satisfy all. Napoleon informed Marbois that he wanted $20 million, or 100 million francs, for Louisiana, but that he was willing to settle for about $9 million, or 50 million francs. Things got off to a rocky start. Livingston was still resentful of Monroe and what he perceived to be his desire to steal his thunder. Monroe was very well aware of Livingston's enmity, having heard it from an embassy employee, on top of whatever Jefferson and Madison told him. And Livingston's close relationship with Marbois led to a very awkward moment the day Monroe joined him. Livingston and Monroe were having dinner with other American officials when they noticed someone looking at them through the window in the garden outside. One member of the group noticed it was Marbois. They went out to greet Marbois, who claimed that he just happened to be in the area, kind of a comedic moment here. They invited Marbois to join them. Later that night, Marbois invited Livingston alone to his office, not including Monroe. All awkwardness aside, Marbois told Livingston that Napoleon had requested $20 million, or 100 million francs, for all of Louisiana. Livingston knew that number was negotiable. Marbois advised Livingston to think long and hard about their counteroffer. Now, it's important to understand just how stunning this was for Livingston. To give us some frame of reference, let's recall that Jefferson was willing to pay about $9 million for Florida and New Orleans. Now it appeared that France was willing to offer a giant chunk of the entire continent, fertile land, as well as virtual command of the Mississippi River to them for just twice the price they were willing to pay for New Orleans and Florida, and maybe even less. But many obstacles remained. The first was the issue of its borders, especially with Canada and Spanish Texas. Most of the territories had never been surveyed or even seen by Americans, so the borders were ill-defined. It was very possible that the British and the Spanish might dispute the exact location of the borders. The second is whether the Florida territories were actually part of the Louisiana Territory. They were part of the Spanish Empire's possession, and France could probably coerce Spain to give them up, but it wasn't clear under what context that could occur. But even worse was the treaty between Spain and France that gave France the territory in the first place. It included a proviso that France couldn't divest itself of Louisiana to anyone other than Spain. The selling of Louisiana to America violated the treaty. And lastly, there was the problem of Britain. If America, Britain's recent enemy, acquired Louisiana, how would London react? Would they go to war against the United States? Would America be willing to risk that? In fact, Madison wrote Livingston and Monroe a letter instructing them that if the sale was completed, to reassure the British ambassador in France that it wouldn't harm his country's interests. 2 days later, on April 15th, Livingston and Monroe presented their counteroffer to Marbois, about $8 million or 40 million francs. It was close to the maximum that Jefferson told Monroe in his instructions, but less than half of the $20 million Napoleon offered. They knew that it would be rejected, which it was, but they gambled that Marbois wouldn't walk out, and they were right. They then raised their offer to about $9 million, or 50 million francs, basically what Jefferson offered for just Florida and New Orleans. Marbois, again, was reluctant. He said that Napoleon's lower limit was about $15 million, or 80 million francs. There the offer sat, the two sides at an impasse. The price, along with other outstanding questions, like defining the borders and the status of Florida, stalled negotiations. 2 weeks passed. The fate of the territory and the security of the United States remained up in the air. As the month drew to a close, both sides realized that the issue of borders and of Florida couldn't be settled there and had to be discussed with Britain and Spain, so they decided to focus on the price for Louisiana. On April 27th, 1803, Livingston and Monroe met with Marbois and now offered about $14 million, or 70 million francs. They were testing Marbois, but willing to accept Napoleon's final offer of $15 million. When Marbois rejected them, the two envoys put their cards on the table and accepted Napoleon's minimum. Finally, Marbois accepted. With that, France agreed to sell 828,000 acres to the United States. Livingston and Monroe had their deal. The American and French officials shook hands and exchanged toasts. Livingston proclaimed, quote, "We have lived long, but this has been the noblest work of our whole lives." When Marbois informed Napoleon that he had sold Louisiana for 80 million francs, the French dictator complained, saying that he had wanted 100 million francs. Marbois reminded him that he said he would take 50 million, and that he improved on that by getting 80 million. Napoleon responded with a glare of displeasure. On May 1st, an official reception was held, and Livingston and Monroe dined with Napoleon. The next day, May 2nd, the treaty was signed. That same month, Britain declared war on France, beginning the War of the Third Coalition. So remember what I said about diplomacy taking a long time back then? Well, word of the treaty didn't reach Jefferson and Madison until July 3rd, 1803, the day before American Independence Day. The president, the secretary of state, and the rest of the cabinet were stunned and overjoyed by their good fortune, and just in time to celebrate the nation's 27th birthday. News of the treaty slowly spread across the United States. When it did, most Americans celebrated it as a sign of divine favor. Their country, one of the youngest in the world, was now even bigger in size than Europe. In their eyes, liberty was expanding to new frontiers. The treaty's widespread support made it inevitable that Congress would ratify it. But for Jefferson, it posed a philosophical dilemma. As I mentioned earlier, he was a strict constructionist, and the Constitution said nothing about acquiring territory. Jefferson feared that by exercising a power not explicitly stated in the Constitution, he would open the door to the elastic interpretation championed by the Federalists. While acquiring territory might lead to good in one instance, it could lead to an overbearing and tyrannical federal government claiming limitless powers. He worried that he was securing his country's interest abroad while sacrificing liberty at home. For some, it might seem like a silly dilemma. After all, Jefferson had the opportunity to double his nation's size and eliminate a major European presence in North America. Would he allow constitutional niceties from preventing that? But Jefferson genuinely feared the negative consequences of claiming an unprecedented amount of authority. The president brooded over the decision and considered getting an amendment to the Constitution ratified to justify the purchase, and therefore to narrowly define the government's power to acquire territory. And the other thing was the debt the purchase would add to the country's ledger. Under Presidents Washington and Adams, Jefferson attacked the Federalists for incurring increases of national debt. And now here he was, potentially adding to that debt with an extravagant purchase. And this is where you see the dynamics of the partnership between Jefferson and his pragmatic right-hand man, Madison. The Secretary of State strongly advised the president to disavow the amendment process, which was long and arduous. They had to seize the moment. There were signs that delay could jeopardize the entire agreement. Monroe and Livingston, still in Paris, reported that Napoleon was having second thoughts and felt, quote, chagrin at what he may have considered to be a bad bargain. And when the Spanish government got word of the treaty, the Spanish Minister of Foreign Affairs, Pedro de Ceballos, understandably cried foul, reminding the French that the original agreement prevented the secession of Louisiana to anyone but Spain. Jefferson strongly believed in limited government power, but as we discussed earlier, he was a political pragmatist, and Madison was there to guide and direct him back to seeing the realities of politics. Instead of pushing for an amendment, Jefferson caved to Madison and asked the Senate to ratify the treaty. Despite the treaty's overwhelming popularity among both Federalists and Republicans, some members of Congress voiced concerns. They asked, as Jefferson did, whether it legitimated too much presidential and federal power, and what all this meant for the Native Americans in the territories. Some even wondered whether the United States could maintain a republic over such a large area, fearing that it would require a stronger federal government to manage it. Remember, most of the states in America were already the size of whole European countries. Some of the opposition came from New England merchants who, as before, feared that their economic power would be diluted by new markets in the West. But these questions couldn't get in the way of the benefits it gave to American security and prosperity. The Senate ratified the agreement on October 20, 1803, by a vote of 24-7, greater than a 3-1 margin. When the bill to fund the treaty came up in the House, it was passed, again by an overwhelming margin, 89 votes to 23. By then, President Jefferson's private secretary, Captain Meriwether Lewis, and his close friend, Second Lieutenant William Clark, were preparing to lead an expedition to explore and map out the newly acquired territory. By May of the following year, they began their 2-year journey, which would take them to the Pacific Ocean and back. The successful purchase of Louisiana solidified national approval of President Jefferson and his Republican Party. The United States had doubled overnight, and the threat of invasion from France was all but gone. When all expenses were taken into account, the entire cost to the United States was a stunning 3 cents an acre. In November 1804, President Jefferson won re-election over Federalist Charles Pinckney by what remains today the biggest popular vote margin in which there were multiple major party candidates, 73% to 27%, a 46 percentage point difference. Unfortunately for Robert Livingston, Jefferson's running mate that year was not him, but another New York Republican, Governor George Clinton. Jefferson's two disciples, James Madison and James Monroe, would succeed him as president, both serving 2 terms and maintaining significant popularity. In fact, James Monroe was elected in 1820 unopposed, winning all but 1 electoral vote, the closest anyone has come to Washington's unanimous elections in 1789 and 1792. Monroe's presidency took place during a time known in American history as the Era of Good Feelings, a time of unusual political harmony and national prosperity. And as president, Monroe issued his famous doctrine in 1823, where he declared that the United States opposed European colonialism in the American continents. In doing so, he enunciated the principles of an independent America, free from European interference, the same principles that led his predecessor to purchase Louisiana in the first place. The presidential dynasty built by Thomas Jefferson remains the most successful in American history, in large part due to the prosperity and security obtained from the Louisiana Purchase. New Orleans, 1814. While the United States laid claim to Louisiana, that wasn't the end of the story. By 1812, James Madison was in the middle of his presidency, and James Monroe was now his Secretary of State, and they found themselves saber-rattling with Great Britain. The Napoleonic Wars in Europe continued to rage, and Britain blockaded American ships from conducting commerce with the French. Again, this involved impressing American sailors. And the British continued to incite Native Americans to conduct raids on American civilians in Western territories. This was all done to inhibit American expansionism into the West. For their part, many Americans wanted to annex Canada and Florida, the latter of which was still claimed by the Spanish, adding to tensions with Europe. This desire for annexation reflected a desire for conquest by some, but also the ever-present fear of foreign invasion by either the British or the Spanish. Many Americans felt that having any European power next door would mean the perpetual threat of invasion, and in a sense, that was a reasonable fear. By June 1812, President Madison obtained a declaration of war on the British, pushing America into the War of 1812. However, America, as before, remained ill-prepared to face the European superpower and suffered crushing defeats in New York, Canada, and Washington, D.C., where the British famously burned the White House and the U.S. Capitol. But by late 1814, the Americans were finally able to repulse British forces at Plattsburgh, New York, ending the invasion of the northern states, and Baltimore, ending the invasion of the mid-Atlantic states. They were also able to shatter Tecumseh's Native American Confederacy allied with the British. Historians believe that the British still hoped to secure the Mississippi River and take over the Louisiana Territory, either to keep it or to give it back to their Spanish allies. In the eyes of the British, Spain being a weakened empire would probably be less aggressive than American Western settlers. So despite all the work by Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, Livingston, and their French counterparts back in 1803, the Louisiana Territory remained insecure, and the threat of European invasion from Florida still loomed. Enter Andrew Jackson. By this time, the rugged Tennessean was in his mid-40s, and he had served as a congressman, a justice on the Tennessee Supreme Court, and as the commander of his state's militia. By the time the War of 1812 broke out, Jackson was itching to end the threat from Florida by defeating the Creek Native Americans that were supported by the British. Since we were already at war with Britain, Monroe was concerned that Jackson might start another war, this time with Spain, if he invaded Florida. So he sent Jackson a message to lay off Florida. Jackson ignored it and crushed the Creeks by the fall of 1814, forcing them to hand over about 20 million acres of land. His reputation as an Indian killer was just beginning. Britain responded by sending an armada of 60 ships with about 15,000 men led under Vice Admiral Alexander Cochrane to take over New Orleans. It was just a fight that Jackson wanted. In his youth, Jackson had suffered immensely as a prisoner under the British during the American Revolution, and he was itching for revenge. The British troops were among the best the empire could muster, specifically trained for an attack on New Orleans, the gateway to the continent. Jackson entered the port city on December 1, 1814, and controversially declared martial law. The British arrived by late December. On December 23rd, a vanguard British force led by John Keane found an undefended opening on the east bank of the Mississippi River, which put them within 9 miles of New Orleans. It was an inexplicable oversight by Jackson and his men. At that point, the British could have taken over the crucial city, a major step in taking over the Louisiana Territory. But he thought the route was too dangerous and awaited reinforcements. It was a fateful decision. Jackson soon learned of the British position and sent men to close the gap. Arriving on the scene was Lieutenant General Edward Pakenham one of Britain's top officers and brother-in-law to the man who defeated Napoleon, the Duke of Wellington. Although Jackson's force remained vulnerable, the British hesitated again, giving the Americans time to fortify their position in defense of the city. At the same time, a couple thousand Kentucky militiamen arrived to reinforce Jackson. Taking all the help he could get, his force included free blacks, Choctaw Native Americans, and French pilots. Still, with less than 5,000 troops, Jackson was outnumbered by about 3-1. On January 8, 1815, Pakenham ordered a two-prong attack on the Americans, and the battle was on. Despite his earlier vulnerability, Jackson had effectively hardened his position by building a massive rampart and widening the canal outside the city. And Jackson's men had the advantage of having highly accurate shooters. In the heat of the battle, the British committed a fatal error. Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Mullins forgot to bring the ladders needed to scale the canal and the Americans' rampart. The result was a devastating defeat for the British. The numbers were stunning. Although they outnumbered the Americans 3-1, the British suffered over 2,000 casualties in less than half an hour. All the while, the Americans lost less than 100 men. Secretary Monroe soon wrote to Jackson, quote, "History records no example of so glorious a victory obtained with so little bloodshed on the part of the victorious." The victory electrified the nation and made Andrew Jackson a national hero. One observer wrote that news of the result, quote, "came upon the country like a clap of thunder and traveled with electromagnetic velocity throughout the confines of the land." Remember how I said that diplomacy and information moved much slower during this time? The Treaty of Ghent ending the War of 1812 had been signed weeks before the decisive battle, but the victory of New Orleans prevented another European attempt to take over the Mississippi and America's Western territories. Since the War of 1812, no foreign power had initiated a significant invasion and occupation of the United States. Less than 3 years after the Battle of New Orleans, the new president, James Monroe, ordered Jackson to pacify the Seminole tribes. In doing so, Jackson took over all of Florida, ending Spanish rule. His overwhelming popularity eventually led to his election in 1828 as the 7th president of the United States. He governed as a self-proclaimed follower of Thomas Jefferson.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
Conclusion. I mentioned at the start of this episode that history often seems inevitable, and that when we view it that way, we lose something. The story behind the Louisiana Purchase is a case in point. To us, it almost seems as inevitable. Since the country began on the East Coast and ended up taking over the entire continent, the Louisiana Purchase seems just like a logical step in the entire process. But when we view it that way, we lose all of the unique circumstances and decisions that led to the outcome. Consider the following. First, the highly complex situation on the North American continent, which was the object of British, French, and Spanish imperial ambitions, as well as those of the United States and numerous Native American tribes. Second, the fortuitous timing of the rebellion in Saint-Domingue, in which disease and guerrilla warfare drained French blood and the national treasury. This point must not be taken lightly. Many Americans were ambivalent towards this rebellion. Many Southerners felt that it would inspire a slave rebellion at home. But it very likely benefited the United States. The event now known as the Haitian Revolution is considered the largest slave rebellion since Spartacus and one of the very few successful ones in all of history. The quagmire, often called France's Vietnam, displayed to Napoleon the cost of maintaining colonies in the Western Hemisphere and increased the attractiveness of selling Louisiana for quick cash. Think also of the severe winter that stranded French troops in Holland, preventing them from reinforcing troops already in Saint-Domingue. Third, the fortuitous timing of hostilities between France and Britain. Although their war had ended in 1801, by 1803 war broke out again, making it necessary for France to look for cash to pay for troops and weapons. Madison himself had hoped for war between the two European powers, which could work in favor of the United States. Fourth, the Spanish closure of New Orleans in 1802. The uproar in the United States among citizens of different regions and political stripes demonstrated to France its resolve to protect its interests in New Orleans and the Mississippi. Fifth, the impulsiveness of Napoleon Bonaparte. As I mentioned earlier, he was not afraid to make a snap decision on the fly, even if it meant renouncing an empire in North America. Indeed, his forces ordered to Saint-Domingue were ultimately supposed to take New Orleans and secure such an empire. And if he wanted to get rid of Louisiana, he could have given the territory back to Spain rather than sell it to America. Some historians believe that he ultimately sold it to the Americans in a long-term plan to empower Britain's enemy, the United States. Some of them quote Napoleon saying the following, quote, "I regarded the colony as already lost, and it seems to me that in the hands of this newborn power, it will be more useful to the policy and even to the commerce of France than if I should try to retain it." Another quote by Napoleon, quote, "I have given to England a maritime rival, which will sooner or later humble her pride." A last quote, "Perhaps it will be objected that the Americans may be found too powerful for Europe in 2 or 3 centuries, but my foresight does not embrace such remote fears." And when you think about it, although our focus has been on the American side, Napoleon was the one with the cards in his hands. He ultimately made the decision to sell the territory to the United States. When we think of Napoleon, we think of him for his military accomplishments and the legal and government institutions he imposed in Europe. Could it be that his greatest legacy was expanding the United States, sending it on a course to dominate North American resources and become the greatest world power? Have you ever thought of Napoleon Bonaparte as an architect of American power? Sixth, the diplomatic prowess of Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe, and Robert Livingston. I emphasize the first two, Jefferson and Madison, because of their long experience in government as either ministers to foreign countries or back home in various state and federal congresses gave them the political skills to influence the world's greatest empires. The information and misinformation they provided to their envoys abroad or to French diplomats like Pichon, Talleyrand, and Marbois was critical in convincing the government in Paris of American seriousness in defending Louisiana. Their skills allowed the United States to overcome its overwhelming inferiority in military might and its status as an infant nation. Seventh, British hesitation in the Battle of New Orleans. The British were 9 unguarded miles away from taking over New Orleans, but hesitation plus incompetence doomed their best chance to secure the lifeblood of the Western American economy. Eighth, the audacity of Andrew Jackson. Many other American leaders like George Washington and Winfield Scott were known for their scrupulous attention to civilian and international law. Not so with Andrew Jackson. His combination of courage, determination, and disregard for legal niceties and anyone other than white Americans allowed him to defeat the British, the Spanish, and various Native American tribes to secure the Louisiana Territory once and for all, and even take over Spanish Florida. All this is made more fascinating by the fact that Napoleon violated his treaty with Spain to sell the territory to the United States. One historian even described Jefferson as, quote, "a receiver of stolen goods," and, quote, "an accomplice of the greatest highwayman of the age." Rather than being inevitable, America's acquisition of the territory rested on circumstances outside its control, on the whims of a French dictator, and on the brilliance and daring of its leaders. In light of these circumstances, observers came to see the stunningly good fortune of the American Republic. By the middle of the 19th century, it became fashionable to say, quote, "God takes care of children, drunken men, and the United States." In my first episode on this podcast, the one about George Washington, I talked about how uncertain the American Revolution was, how close the U.S. Army was to collapsing. Washington would later say that divine providence alone got America through those times. When you think about that, and you think about the good fortune America has had in this episode, you start getting an idea of why Americans started believing that their country was uniquely blessed. And it was that belief, for better or for worse, which fueled the era known as Manifest Destiny. The impact of the Louisiana Purchase on American history is undeniable. Without the rest of the North American continent, it is unlikely that the United States could have continued to expand and become a truly continental power. Without Louisiana, America might not have been able to achieve its rank among the nations. In the words of historian Henry Adams, the great-grandson of John Adams and grandson of John Quincy Adams, the purchase was, quote, "next in historical importance to the Declaration of Independence and the adoption of the Constitution. It was unparalleled in diplomacy because it cost almost nothing." Louisiana Purchase was a victory for the United States and whites settling out west. But for African Americans, it meant new territory to extend the institution that enslaved them. The expansion of slavery, which would accelerate with the defeat of Mexico in the 1840s, would continue to divide the nation. Ultimately, this impasse would be solved by nothing short of a devastating civil war. And for the Native American population that was already dwindling, it meant that whites could legally claim even more territory as their own. President Jefferson himself had advocated for Native Americans to either shift their societies towards organized agriculture or accept removal. These policies, followed by his successors, culminated in the Indian Removal Act under Andrew Jackson. Thousands of natives perished along what would be known as the Trail of Tears during his presidency. I remember in college taking an American history class and getting the far-left view, the view of America as an aggressive country that expanded chiefly through the annexation of land that it had no right to, of a hypocritical nation that professed liberty but brought slavery to new lands, and add to that the reasonable claim that Louisiana was stolen goods. Some of these criticisms have validity. It is a fact that American slavery was extended into the new territories, and it is a fact that white settlers encroached on Native American territories. But as always, the truth is much more complicated, and I hope that this episode will give you a greater appreciation for that complexity. Put yourself in 1803. Pretend that you're an American citizen at that time. You live in an infant country and the only large-scale republic in the world. That republic is a great experiment in self-government with major implications for the world. You've seen your nation sacrifice its lives and treasure to win independence. Dispersed across your country are Native American tribes. While they are justifiably upset about white settlers encroaching their lands, they are also being incited to violence against American citizens, sometimes by the country you just fought a war to be rid of. And your country, young and fragile as it is surrounded by hostile European powers with a history of conquest. To you, they appear to threaten your security and very livelihoods. And remember the sense of urgency given the weakness of your country. And suddenly, one of those European powers offers your country a massive buffer zone in the West that will protect it from foreign intervention. What would you do? We know what Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, and Jackson did. In doing so, they earned their place among the great architects of American power. To what degree their actions were justified will forever be debated. But what cannot be debated is the fact that the Louisiana Purchase was an indispensable chapter in American history, for without it, the United States could never have risen to become the most powerful nation in the world. If you want to learn more about today's episode, check out Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power by John Meacham, Jefferson's Great Gamble by Charles Serramy, and James Madison, A Life Reconsidered by Lynn Cheney. This American President is produced by myself, Richard Lim, and Michael Neal, with help from Jennifer Steinhoff. Thanks to my dad, Bert Chu. The music in this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions. We also want to thank our Patreon supporters. You too can support us by going to patreon.com/thisamericanpresident and giving any amount you choose per episode that we release. If you like what you've been hearing, you can also help us by sharing an episode on Twitter or Facebook. I'm Richard Lim. We're back next time with more This American President.
Coming up on 5 Minute News, I'm Anthony Davis. You might think it's partisan because maybe it's critical of one side or the other, but it's not. It's just the truth. And I think that's also something that's kind of unusual for Americans listening to the radio or to podcasts, because the news landscape in the States has been so partisan for so many decades. So 5 Minute News is verified, truthful, independent, unbiased, and essential world news daily.